Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Chatham Community Church. My name is Jaime. I'm one of the pastors here. I'm glad to welcome you all here this morning. If you happen to be a guest, a particularly warm welcome to you, whether it's your first time with us or it's been a while. Glad that you're here. I'd love to say hi to you at the end of the service, so I'll be just outside the exit doors. Come stop by and say hi. I'd be glad to hear your name, a little bit more about how you found us and how you ended up in Chatham County and your experience here with us today. A while back, I was reading a book, a short book, containing biographies, short biographies, on important figures in U.S. history. I think it was 13 chapters, so 13 biographies. It's a diverse cast of characters from U.S. history, from the founding all the way to modern day. And one of the chapters focuses on Thomas Jefferson, who lived a pretty eventful life as part of the founding of this country. The chapter spends a good deal of time talking about the restoration of his relationship with John Adams. For those of you that don't know, Adams and Jefferson were the second and third presidents of this country. They were colleagues who became rivals to the point that their relationship broke apart. But later in life, they started to engage in correspondence once again with one another, and they rebuilt a friendship. In the chapter, the author details much about that restored relationship and spends a good bit of time talking about the fact that they even ended up dying on the same day, and that day happened to be July 4th. And then Adams' final recorded words before he slipped into the final sleep were about Jefferson. Now, there's a lot that you could write about Thomas Jefferson. Many people have written tomes about Jefferson. He lived a very eventful life and played a key role in the founding of this country. But this is a book that only dedicates a short chapter to his life. Why would you invest so much space in talking about not just the restoration of a relationship, but the stuff that happens right near the end of their life? Why would you even choose to include the final words of not Jefferson, but Adams? I think some of it is because of the curiosity that they died on the same day and that that same day happened to be July 4th, and because the words of Adams were about Jefferson. Because what are the odds of that happening? Very rare. But I suspect that some of it is precisely because these are things that happened right near the end of life. And for some reason, we give some weight to the things that happen near the end. We care about people's final words. We care about the things that we say to them and making sure that we're with people at the last moments, the things that happen near the end. We pay attention to the things that happen as life comes to a close. That trend is throughout history. I think it's true of humanity. It's certainly reflected in the pages of Scripture. It's reflected in the accounts that we have of Jesus' life. There are four accounts of Jesus' life in the New Testament to start the New Testament. They're the books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all encompassing 89 chapters. So 89 chapters to cover Jesus' life. A third of them focus on the last week of Jesus' life. And a good chunk of that third is actually focused on the hours before he is arrested and crucified. They're focused on what he says, what he does, what he prays for in those final hours. That's what we're calling our series here at Chatham Community Church. From now until Easter, we're going to be talking about those final hours. We're going to spend time with Jesus and his disciples as the time draws near for him to be arrested, tried, and crucified. We're going to see how he prepares them for what's to come, not just in the immediate future, but what's going to come in the aftermath and on the other side of that. What we'll see is that what Jesus does, what Jesus says, and how Jesus prays in those final hours, what he has in mind in those final hours, is not just focused on them, on the 12 that are around him. It's focused on all of us as well. The passage Patty read for us comes from what's known as Jesus' upper room discourse. Jesus has celebrated the Passover meal with his disciples and has been teaching them. They are engaged in conversation and in dialogue as part of that teaching. Just in the lead up to this chapter, Jesus has gotten very deep and very heavy. He's talked about his death. He's talked about betrayal. He's talked about denial. It's starting to get alarming, right? If you could imagine the temperature in the room, it is starting to go up. And it's not just because they live in the desert at that time. Jesus has talked about his death leading up to this part. Now, let's be clear, none of them are anticipating Jesus dying, even though Jesus has said he would. None of them are anticipating this. They are expecting that somehow they have come to Jerusalem for him to overthrow the Roman occupation and reestablish the kingdom of Jerusalem, the kingdom of Israel. That's what they're expecting is going to happen in the next week. He's not only talked about his death, he's talked about betrayal. And not just betrayal, but that one of them is going to be the one who betrays him, which leads to his death. Imagine how disorienting that must feel for this group of tight friends that have been navigating together for 3 years, having left their jobs, having left their livelihoods, having left their towns and villages in an era where people did not travel very far from where they grew up. How must it feel to hear that one of them is going to betray him? To top it all off, in response to all this, as one of them says and declares his undying and unyielding loyalty to Jesus, Jesus says to him, "You're actually going to deny me over and over again." And suddenly the celebratory atmosphere that had welcomed them into Jerusalem starts to dissipate from the room. It is getting serious. Now, some of this stuff is new to them, but some of it is not. Certainly the stuff about his death is not. His teachings have been pointing to a kingdom and a reign that is unlike what they were picturing. And he's been trying to get them to understand that, but they have failed to grasp it. They have failed to come to grips with it. They've spent 3 years with him, and they still haven't gotten it. And it is about to hit them like a freight train. They're not the only ones who got hit like a freight train. Life hits us like a freight train sometimes, doesn't it? Things happen. Sometimes they happen unexpectedly. Sometimes it's just an accumulation of things that we finally face or process or deal with, and it feels like we're in a spot that we weren't expecting to be, or we're in a way that we weren't prepared to handle. It feels like life has smacked us. Ever been in that spot? That's where the disciples are, and that's where they're headed. And Jesus has a word for them. When you find yourself in a similar situation now, whether you find yourself in a similar situation now where it feels like life has hit you like a freight train, whether you remember one in the past or whether one is going to come in the future, the word that Jesus has for his disciples is actually a word for us as well. Jesus has a word for us. Not just for the moments when life hits us like a freight train, but to prepare us for those moments that might come. His words to the disciples are as relevant to us today in Chatham County as they were in that upper room 2,000 years ago. In the face of all the talk about his death, about betrayal, about denial, and all the angst that it's causing his disciples, Jesus shares a word. He says, "Do not let your hearts be troubled." And that is jarring at first, because he's given them plenty of reasons for their hearts to be troubled. I'm going to die, one of you is going to betray me, and you are going to deny me. That's troubling, folks. And when the soldiers show up to arrest him, it's going to be troubling. When he's put on trial, it's going to be troubling. As he's carrying the cross, it's going to be troubling. As he's nailed to that cross, it's going to be troubling. As they get the news that he's in the tomb, it is going to be troubling. And yet Jesus says, "Do not let your hearts be troubled." Devoid of context, Jesus' words sound like those hollow statements of "relax, it's no big deal, don't worry," that people make when they don't understand the gravity of a situation, or it seems like they don't understand the gravity of a situation, or they can't relate to what we're going through. You ever been in that spot when someone has said that to you and you feel like, do you have any idea what's going on here? This is not a relaxed kind of situation. Stuff just got real. If you've been the recipient of comments like that, you know it can feel hollow. You know it can feel like you're misunderstood. It can even feel dismissive of the emotional weight that we carry in moments like that, moments when life hits us like a freight train. Let's be honest, some of us have offered those kinds of words at moments as well. Sometimes it's because we didn't get the situation, and later on when we understand, we realize the mistake of those words. Sometimes we share them because we don't know what else to say in those moments, don't we? But there has to be something different going on here. Jesus can't be sharing empty platitudes here. He can't be painting a picture, a real picture of what's ahead, only to be saying, relax recreationally. He can't be dismissing the emotional weight that they're about to feel. That would be entirely out of character for Jesus. There has got to be more going on. And it starts becoming clear that there's more going on when he adds to that sentence. He doesn't say, do not let your hearts be troubled. He says, you believe in God, believe also in me. Jesus' exhortation to not let their hearts be troubled is coupled with an invitation. It's not just an exhortation, it's an exhortation with an invitation to believe in him, an invitation to trust in him. Why? Well, remember, he's the one who's told them that it's about to get real, that the freight train is about to hit them. He's the one who's been framing the situation that's to come. He's been painting the grim picture that's about to become a reality. If he's telling them that they can be at peace in their hearts, if he's encouraging them or inviting them to believe in him, he, and it's genuine, if it's genuine, then he must know that ultimately it is going to be all right. He must know that ultimately all will be well. He must know that ultimately it will have all been worth it. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to sit with families and be with families, with kids, as they're showing their kids movies that they enjoyed or watched in their youth. Maybe you've had that experience as well. And, you know, invariably, there are moments in movies, even kids' movies, surprisingly, where things get kind of tense and sometimes scary. And more often than not, I've seen in those moments the kids kind of curl up next to their parent or in the crook of their arm, almost like saying, what are you showing me here? Is this safe to watch? And invariably the parent will say something like, don't worry, it's okay. It's going to be all right. And you can see the child's shoulders sort of loosen up a little bit and then relax and be able to engage in the movie again. They release a little bit of that tension. They take a deep breath. They keep going. It's not just because of the words. It's because of the words are coming from someone that they trust and someone who knows what's on the other side of that tense moment, who knows that it is going to be all right and whom they trust when they tell them it's all right. It's kind of like that here with Jesus. When Jesus is saying these things, it's not empty platitudes. He's not trying to placate. He's painting a picture of what it's going to be like, but he knows that on the other side of it, it will be well. He knows that they can be at peace. When Jesus says, do not let your hearts be troubled, believe in me, he does so knowing that what's on the other side is far better than what he's saying is going to happen and what will happen. Because on the other side of the betrayal, on the other side of the denial, on the other side of the crucifixion, on the other side of the death, there is resurrection. There is restoration. There is the emergence of a different kind of community, the church that you and I get to be part of. It is the knowledge of that which makes Jesus' words, do not let your hearts be troubled, not be empty platitudes, but actually be words of comfort. And words of hope, words of encouragement. They extend an invitation to the disciples. They extend an invitation to us to believe and trust in Jesus. Because Jesus knows what's happening in your life right now. Jesus knows what's coming. And Jesus knows the way through all of it. And on the other side of all of it, there is good. On a grand scale, at the end of all things, there is unending life and there is fullness of goodness of life. There is all of that for us, no matter what we go through in this life. But while we are in it, we're not just left to go through it and suffer through it. God promises his presence. He is with us. He is comforting us. He is encouraging us. He is leading us through it. Whether the freight train has hit you now, whether it has hit you in the past, or whether it might hit you in the future, maybe it'll never hit you at all. God is still there. God is still good. God is still leading with his presence and his promise. Part of that promise is what Jesus talks about next in the passage. It's part of what he's inviting the disciples to trust in him for. It's part of what he invites you and I to trust in him for as Jesus heads towards his arrest and crucifixion. He invites them to trust in him for a place, for a home. Jesus invites them and us to believe that there is a place for each of us, for each one of us, for you and for you and for you and for me. That there is a place that was made for us by the one who made us, by the one who loves us, by the one who knows us, by the one who sees us, and the one who has prepared it for us. And he will take us back to that place. He will bring us to that place. He will bring us home. I love that word home. Because at its best, and I know it's not always at its best for many of us, but at its best, home is a place of welcome. It's a place of rest. It's a place where we are known. It's a place where we are loved. It's a place where we are seen. It's a place where we are received. It's a place where we feel like we can belong, because we do. Like I said, I know that not all of us have had that experience in the places that we've lived, or we've had maybe imperfect versions of that experience. But in all of us, there is a sense when home has not been its ideal, there's this sense that it ought not to be like that. It ought not to be less than the ideal. And that's because we were made for that kind of home that is ideal, where we are seen, where we are loved, where we belong, where we feel like we are welcomed all the time. What we long for is precisely the place that Jesus has prepared for us. It's precisely the place that he invites us to. It's precisely the place that he leads us to. It's what he invites us to trust in him for. One of the common experiences when life hits us like a freight train is that we can feel isolated, alone, and misunderstood. Maybe you felt one of those in those moments. Maybe you felt a combination. Maybe you felt all three. In the moments when we feel most alone, and we feel tempted to think that we've been abandoned, maybe even by God, we have these words of Jesus to turn to. We can believe Jesus when he tells us that there is a place for us, a place that has been prepared specifically for us, and that he will bring us there. And that will open the door for the trouble in our heart to dissipate as we make our way through whatever freight train has hit us. As Jesus lays that out for the disciples, they start to get concerned about how to get there, because Jesus is talking about leaving them. They're going to be separated physically from the one that they've been following for 3 years. That's a break in pattern from what they've been doing. So how will they know what the next steps are to take? Well, Jesus tells them that he is the way, that he is the truth, that he is the life. He is the path to get to the Father, to get home. If they keep their focus on him, even if he's not physically present with him, they'll be able to know what the next step to take is, and they'll be able to take it. And not just the next step, but the one after that and all the ones that follow as well. They'd been imagining what their future was going to be like. They had visions of the positions that they would occupy in this new kingdom that Jesus was going to inaugurate. They maybe had visions of what they do in those positions. Maybe they'd mapped out scenarios of what the next few years were going to be like in their heads. And all of that is going to prove moot in just a little bit. It's all going to feel like it crumbles. And Jesus is telling them that when that happens, they're going to know how to move ahead. They're going to know how to move ahead. They will know how to move, not just ahead, but ahead towards something good, ahead towards something far better than what they had been imagining, what they had been comprehending for themselves, if they keep their focus on him, if they rely on him, if they look to him. It takes a lot of trust to believe in that. It takes a lot of trust to believe in that. And that trust is precisely what Jesus is inviting them to. He's inviting not just them, but us, to trust that in every circumstance, in any and every circumstance, there is a way forward. There is a way forward, and that way forward is towards the good life that we were made for. And that way forward is always found in Jesus. It's always found in Jesus. People often joke that, when you find yourself in sort of a church situation, they do this in sort of the context of imagining a Sunday school, and you get asked a question that you don't know the answer to, just say Jesus, because Jesus tends to be the right answer. You know, there is some truth to that. It's not always the right answer to every Bible quiz question, but it's certainly the right answer in this situation. When you're wondering what the next step is to take, when you're wondering how to get through, when you're wondering what to do or what will get you towards the kind of life that you were made for, the good life, the answer is look to Jesus. Focus on him. It'll work itself out. Jesus knows the way forward. Jesus wants us to move forward. Jesus has the power to remove the obstacles that can get in the way of us moving forward. And Jesus uses that power to remove those obstacles. Jesus calls us to move forward. And Jesus is with us as we move forward. If that's not a reason to look to him, to trust him, and to take those steps and to move forward, I don't know what is. Because what's on the other side, what we move towards, is that life that we've been made for. The life that is lived to the fullest. The life that is lived to the fullest for all time. You ever felt stuck? Felt like your life just got caught in the mud. Maybe you don't know what path to take. Maybe you feel you haven't gotten the right kind of information or can't map things out enough to know how to move forward. Maybe the path feels hard to discern or you feel disoriented about what the right thing to do next is. Jesus invites us in those situations to look to him, to trust in him when he tells us that he is the way, the truth, and the life. And if we stick to following him, if we stick to looking to him, if we stick to trusting in him, we will move towards the kind of life that we were made for. Now, for some of us, stuckness isn't a crisis. It's become a way of life. Because maybe we tried to move forward, and we felt like we got pushed back. And we've kind of maybe in our mind settled. We've said, well, maybe this is all that life is going to be. Maybe this is as good as it's going to get. Maybe I just have to figure out how to live with these sorts of things or in these sorts of situations. God has more for you. No one was made to peak in their 20s or their 30s or their 40s. But the other side of that, there's no such thing as being a dog too old to learn new tricks. Whatever age you are, whatever stage of the journey you're in, however much you've tried and maybe been pushed back, there is always a way ahead towards the life that you were made for. Now, we won't finish it until we cross over into heaven, but there is a step to take. There is growth to be had. There is being more formed into the person you were made to be, more reflecting the goodness of God, more reflecting the mercy of God, more reflecting the love of God, more reflecting of the kindness of God. There is more for you. You have not peaked, and you're not too old to take a step. If you trust in him, he will show you the way forward. The idea that what's ahead is good, that the life is full, that the life is everlasting, is not something I want to take for granted. In the passage, Jesus tells the disciples that there is a place for them and that he's leading them to the Father. He says that if they've known him, they've known the Father and that they've seen the Father. And they ask for proof. They're like, all right, well, show us. Show us. They want him to show them the Father. Because they want the kind of proof that is going to settle their souls, especially as they're starting to grapple with the reality that maybe things are not going to turn out how they expected. Maybe they want to know that what they're about to go through isn't just a fool's errand, that the past 3 years haven't just been a waste. We say here often that the life God has made for us is a good life, a life that is lived to the fullest for all time. We've said it a number of times this sermon. And we invite us, and invite myself, I invite y'all, to trust in that, even as we go through realities that aren't that great. So how do we know that this is worth it? How do we know that this is worth giving your life to? How do we know that this is worth devoting ourselves to? Well, we look to Jesus in the next thing that he invites us to trust him for. Jesus reveals the heart of the Father. He shows us a God who is worth devoting our whole lives to. When you look at Jesus, when you read about him, when you imagine him, when you listen about him, what you have is a very personal expression of what God is like. In all of his majesty, in all of his splendor, in all of his radiance, Jesus shows us what God is like. So if you want to know if God is worth following, if this is worth giving your life to, if this is worth trusting in, if the life that's on the other side of this is truly a good life, if it's truly a full life, because let me tell you, there will be moments in this life where we will be called to sacrifice things that we feel should be for us and should be good, but they're not the best. How do we know that it's worth it? Well, we look to Jesus. Because if we look to Jesus, we see what God is like. And what do we see about God when we see Jesus? We see a God that is relational. We see a friend. We see a brother. We see a teacher. We see someone who is in relationship and shows us what it's like to be in relationship with God. We see that the maker of all the universe wants to be in relationship with you and with me. And let me just clarify, it is not like that in every other religion. It is like that in some, but it is not like that in every other religion. That the God who made us wants to be in relationship with us, connected to us. What you see in Jesus about God is you see trustworthiness. Throughout Jesus' life, there is no lie found in him. He keeps his word. He is committed to those he loves. He finishes the work. He treats people with care and dignity. He is worth trusting. He tells the truth. He sees the truth in us and he calls it out. He sees the things that are good and calls them out. He sees the things that are not good and calls them out, not to shame us, but to call us to the people that we were made to be, to invite us into health and well-being. And we see a Jesus who is always good. And I don't want us to take that for granted, because in the first century world, gods weren't always good. Gods were willful. Gods had their own agenda. And gods didn't reveal that agenda to people. You didn't know what you were going to get from the gods. Sometimes you would get a boon. Sometimes you wouldn't. But in Jesus, you see a God that is always good. In Jesus, we see someone who had tons of opportunities and the capacity to do harm, to be less gracious. And Jesus never takes those opportunities. He is always gracious, always does good. The God who made us, the God who saves us, the God who loves us, the God who relates to us is always good. And this is awe-inspiring. This is the kind of thing that calls forth our trust. This is the kind of thing that invites our worship. This is the kind of thing that makes this life worth giving all of our lives to. In Jesus, we see so much more about God: care, mercy, forgiveness, humility, power, grace, sacrificial giving, a commitment to sticking with people. Even when they prove themselves not worth sticking with, Jesus sticks with them. And he does that with us as well. This is what God is like. If you ever wonder what God is like, and whether he is worth following, whether he is worth being faithful to, whether he is worth the trust, whether he is worth giving up some opportunities, whether he is worth some of the sacrifice, whether he is worth turning the other cheek, whether he is worth repaying with good the ill that is done to us, believe Jesus when he says that he and the Father are one. Because the picture that Jesus paints, that the Gospels paints of Jesus, the picture that Jesus paints of God is of someone who is worth giving our lives to. Someone worth following. Someone worth trusting. Look at the fruit of Jesus' life and you'll see what kind of world God wants to bring about. and God is bringing about. It's the kind of world we would all want to be part of. The invitation for today is not going to feel surprising because it's what we've been talking about all sermon long. The invitation for today and for all of Lent is to believe and trust in Jesus. And I'd like to invite you to take a moment and see where that invitation is landing for you today. There are ways for all of us at every moment to deepen our belief and to grow in our trust in Jesus. If you happen to find yourself today in a hardship or a challenge, the freight train has hit you. And perhaps the invitation for you today is to hear Jesus' word, "Do not let your heart be troubled," to receive that peace from God, to believe that on the other side of this, and Jesus can guide you to that other side, there is something good. Perhaps you're here, you've never trusted your life with Jesus. Today's the moment to do that, to make a decision, to believe that Jesus is Savior and Lord, that he loves you, that he gave his life for you, and that in him you can have the life everlasting for all time. Maybe that's the invitation for you today. Maybe you've got a place where you need to head in life, a choice that you need to make, a direction that you're seeking for, and you're calculating the pros and cons using whatever decision matrix or rubric you use. Maybe God is saying, "Bring this to me. Look to me." Maybe the invitation is to trust Jesus, to focus on him for the path forward. Maybe it's for the rest of your life, for your future. Whatever it is, as I pray now, would you see where God leads you? Because I'm going to pray for the Spirit to lead you to one of those. And as you sense that, would you deposit your trust in him? Pray with me. Jesus, thank you. Thank you that whether the freight train has hit us, whether we're in it right now, whether it's long past, or whether it is yet to come, and may it not come, you say these words to us: "Do not let your heart be troubled." Lord, wherever our hearts are troubled right now, would we hear your words? Would we hear your words? Would we hear the invitation to believe in you, to trust in you for the good that you've promised? Lord, guide us in the decisions we need to make. Guide us by showing us how to walk. Lord, invite us to trust in you, and may we surrender. Lord, for all of life, may we turn to you. And may we experience the goodness, the mercy, and the kindness. In Jesus' name, amen.